Hello, everyone. I'm very happy to be back to LSEs on the case and extremely excited for another year of interesting podcasts with even more interesting people. Today, I'm pleased to announce that we have two guests joining us, our very own Professor Gary Simpson, who we all know for his brilliant work in the field of public international law. I have to confess, Professor Gary Simpson, that even after 1 year as your student, ahead of this podcast, I was looking at some of your biographies online. And I'm still impressed at the amount of work you have authored and edited and the amount of prizes you have gained. It's incredible. And our other guest, Dr. Tomasz Magalhães, is joining us as well. Tomasz did his undergrad in physics, his master's in nanotechnology, but has dedicated the past few years of his life to one of the most interesting intellectual endeavors within the Portuguese digital space at the moment. Titled Depolariza, or Depolarize in English, this project aims to show us how it is still possible to have intellectually stimulating and peaceful conversations with people whose views are different to ours. Well, first of all, thank you so much for coming and taking some of your time to share your knowledge and experience with our listeners. Professor Gary Simpson, in your article entitled Stop Calling It Aggression, War as a Crime, you bring about some words from the International Military Tribunal. In the Nazi post-war trials, it was said that to initiate war of aggression is not only an international crime, it is the supreme international crime. Now, maybe it's because he has the same name as me, but I'd like to believe that the UN Secretary General does not like international criminality. When you saw him shake hands with Putin, were you expecting him to pull out some handcuffs out of his pocket? Or is it time that we sometimes try to look at alternative ways of mediating and resolving conflict?
It's great to be here with both of you. In fact, I'm looking forward to the discussion across the disciplinary lines. And you're right. So there are, in a way, two ideas circulating in international politics at the moment. One is what I would call a sort of punitive notion of applying criminal law to violators of fundamental legal norms. So people who are regarded as aggressors or genocidaires or people who commit crimes against humanity. And the other is more of a sense that war is a naturally occurring phenomenon in the international system. It's almost a biological phenomenon or a psychological imperative, a la Freud, and that we have to accept it at some level. And that trying to apply law to it is fundamentally flawed. It's like, as one biologist put it, would be like applying international law to the ingestion by one sea slug of another sea slug on the ocean's floor. It feels wrong. It feels like a category error, and it feels amateurish. So I think those who sort of shake hands with Putin are probably taking the latter view that they may not like him. But they don't want to turn him into what Carl Schmitt sort of called the criminal other or the criminal enemy, but rather to think, as people like Schmitt, Foucault, von Clausewitz believed, that war was a sort of extension of politics and political solutions were much more likely to be promising than legal solutions, which are, after all, remarkably novel. This whole idea of applying law to war only really begins in 1918. And it's a great historic project. But I think in order to understand it properly, you have to put it into conversation with other ideas of thinking about international politics.
All right, thanks so much. And I want to go to you now, Tomasz. From a sociological perspective, how much does the law blur the lines, and coming from what Professor Gary Simpson just said, between morally condemning someone for his atrocious actions and functionally finding a way of stopping them? Does the legal discourse put us too far away from the criminal that we are then unable to conceptualize any other alternative?
First of all, thank you for the invitation. I feel like I'm going to be learning more about international relations during this podcast more than I'll be contributing, but here goes. Yeah, I think one of the difficulties is cultural, right? I think morality, it's very hard to universalize morality. There are some attempts which are based on this concept of human universals, so things which multiple cultures which evolved parallel to each other end up having. And when you look at it, it's quite difficult, for instance, to say when aggression is permitted, right? maybe for some cultures such as the West nowadays, using aggressiveness, I'm not even before war, right? Just using aggressiveness on the street is completely unthinkable. But maybe other cultures still live in a moral culture where if someone steals some bread from you, then you are allowed to run after him in the street and beat him up. And so when you apply this to then international war laws, I think there will be something similar, right? There will be some countries who feel that if there's some God-given land which is theirs by God's given right, then they're allowed to use aggression. Others will maybe feel that's not justified. And so, like, the whole problem with, I feel, as a layman, with trying to define war crimes or even criminalize the act of starting war itself with consensus is this cultural problem, right? We still don't live in a world where every single culture has the same moral values.
That makes sense. And we do like to believe, however, that humanity follows an evolutionary path and our civilization is now more sophisticated, rational, morally conscious. International law sometimes used to evidence this. I mean, we saw it in the post-World War I period with Wilson's idealism, then the League of Nations, the post-World War II tribunals, the UN Charter. Have we actually changed, though, is my question. I'm currently studying the development of the Roman Empire, and at the time, whenever the Romans won a war, they used to claim that they were religiously entitled or destined to win it. Nowadays, sometimes after we see a country win a war, we see them as being legally entitled to that territory or legally entitled to dominating that people. Can we create an analogy between these two discourses, or have we actually evolved, or does it actually make sense to talk about it in legal terms, Professor Gary Simpson?
Well, the international legal order has evolved. If the point of international law is to reproduce itself, then it's been a highly successful field. It's become increasingly significant in the way we talk about international politics and war and peace. And the question is really, to what extent does that talk inform the sorts of decisions we make? I take the view, and not because I'm any great advocate of international law, but I take the view that international law is rather important in defining the parameters of our political discourse around war and peace. Whether that political discourse itself has made life better or not is much more of an open question. It could be that international law's development and intensification and the proliferation of institutions associated with it have made very little difference to the behavior of human beings or sovereigns within the structure of interstate relations. That would be at least a plausible claim. Most international lawyers believe that international law has made a difference, along with people like Steven Pinker, for example, who takes a very optimistic view. But some international lawyers don't believe that international law has made that kind of contribution, that things have not changed that much, and that what in fact has happened is that we have replaced unlawful violence with lawful violence to a certain extent. That what we've done is we've taken acts that we would have an instinctive moral revulsion towards and turned them or given them, bestowed on them a certain legitimacy. And that's one of the stories of the sort of post-1918 period, that we've sort of legalized killing at some level. And you see that today with the sorts of discussions that go on. I mean, just to give you a very obvious example, so obvious that people barely notice it. One of the things that the law of war does is it renders legal the killing of combatants by other combatants. It's an unremarkable idea, I suppose, but it's rather interesting. If you want to take the view that killing is abhorrent, or if you want to take the view that we should be moving towards some sort of form of pacifism, then this legitimation of intercombatant killing would seem like a retrograde step. So international law plays all sorts of interesting roles here. It directs attention away from quite a lot of pain and towards other forms of pain. It directs our attention toward genocide and away from poverty. or towards civilian death and away from the death of 16-year-old recruits on the Russian-Ukrainian front, that kind of thing. And I'm not suggesting that there is anything inherently wrong with that, but I think that redistribution of care is something that international law plays a really big part in, and it's rather hidden by its humanitarian progressive pretensions.
Yeah, that makes sense. Tomas, you were talking about different moral values and the way that different societies value different aspects. But when we look at people discussing these issues like war on TV or in the cafe, whatever, do you notice that the legal discourse, the way that the legal, what we're talking about now, like the way that legal terminology enters the realm, contributes to greater polarization, contributes to a more aggressive discussion, and makes it harder for people to understand the different, the other perspective, or to somewhat be able to recognize some legitimacy in trying to negotiate a solution that does not involve legal terminology and legal frameworks?
Well, I don't think it's the legal terms that polarize things. I think it's the definition of specific triggering words, such as genocide, such as invasion, such as self-defense. I don't think that's necessarily related to legal talk, let's say. Picking up on something Gary said, it feels like we still live in the post-Second World War period sometimes. And I say this because I look at the UN Security Council. And for some strange reason, which is the Second World War, France has the power to veto certain decisions, right? And Germany doesn't have that. Portugal doesn't have that. Spain doesn't have that. And so the UN, when I was younger, maybe I was a bit more of an idealist and I thought the UN was more fair than it really is. And nowadays, I see it more as a way for the powerful countries, namely the US and in the past, the allies, to control the world whilst pretending everyone has a bit of a say. And I have evidence for this. Like a few years ago, it was in 2017, Nikki Haley, which was the ambassador to the UN for the United States, after 130 or 128 countries voting against the United States placing their embassy in Jerusalem, she got up on stage and said, "Oh, we're sorry you think that way. We're going to do it anyway. And we're going to write down the names of people who voted against this." And so, and the 128 countries voted against it. And she just got up on stage and said, "We're going to do it anyway. And maybe you'll be punished for voting against us." And for me, that was at least the images I've, of all the images I've seen of the UN, for me, that was the most blatantly obvious case that it's not really about listening and voting. It's more about, okay, everyone gets their voice, everyone can get their problems in, but at the end of the day, it's still about power.
I mean, we've seen also some other examples of that, namely in the invasion of Iraq in the beginning of the century, where some Security Council resolutions were interpreted maybe not the way a toddler or would have interpreted them. So, Professor Gary Simpson, what would you say about this? What's the legal or otherwise moral force that the UN still has in public discourse, and is it still able to avoid or prevent conflict?
Yeah, it's interesting that the French example is a really good example, actually, of the way in which legal rules do, to a certain extent, constitute power in some surprising ways. So France has a seat on the Security Council as a matter of law, you might say. It's in the UN Charter. It's a P5 member. Its veto is protected under the UN security system. And when it exercises the veto, the Security Council can't do anything, or at least in most cases, it doesn't do anything. It's rather remarkable the way that a legal rule like this can influence and constitute global politics in that way, given the absence of power inhering in the French state, or for that matter, the British state. It's not something we would necessarily like, but I think it raises or it makes visible something about the way international law can work. It's surprisingly powerful in many, many respects, but perhaps not in the ways that we either notice or would necessarily approve of. It's probably introduce one of the two or three most fundamental facts of human existence in the 19th and 20th centuries into our lives, namely the idea of sovereignty. The idea of sovereignty organizes planetary relations and indeed lives around the globe. When we're born onto a territory, we receive a passport for that territory, and that passport largely defines our life chances. We might be lucky and get the right sort of passport. We might be very unlucky and end up in an extraordinarily precarious situation. Now, to a certain extent, I guess religious people would say that's God-given, but lawyers at least would say that that's partly a function of this thing called sovereignty. It's just an idea, after all, and it's an idea that's taken hold of the public imagination. It's defined the way global politics works, and it's there when we wake up in the morning and go to bed at night. It's so present that, again, it's like the air. We don't actually notice that we're breathing it in. So I think sovereignty and these legal rules define the way states behave in relation to sovereignty. So one of the effects of sovereignty, for example, on the way we think about Ukraine, Russia, or Israel, Gaza, is the way in which there are a large number of people, say, believe Israel has an obvious right to self-defense under international law, or believe that Ukraine has an obvious right to territorial integrity and political sovereignty under international law. And whether these things are true or false in some other possibly inexistent factual domain, they exist in international law, and they sort of define the way we talk and the sorts of solutions we offer to these conflicts. So I guess I would say that the humanitarian discourses of international law that we hear a lot about, say in the General Assembly or in Amnesty International reports, is a sort of fraction of what international law does. The international law is not largely a humanitarian enterprise at all. It's a way of distributing authority in the world, and it does that, rather successfully. So I've always encouraged people to ask not what international law doesn't do, but rather what it does do in the world. Its failings, if you like, which often are attributed to something called enforceability or enforcement, in a way seem rather obvious. But I do think that focusing on those failings rather distracts us from the work international law does elsewhere and gives us the impression that perhaps it's a discipline of failure. And that, if you want to use it for positive ends, seems like a slightly fetish picture. So I always ask people when they call for the enforcement of international law, what they exactly mean by that. And very often that second question is much more puzzling than the first one. The first one, the answer to the first question is that international law must be enforced. But the answer to the second question, which is who's going to do it and how will it be done? And who will be the legitimate authority for that moment of enforcement is a very, very tricky question. And if you put 12 people into a room, they'll offer 12 different answers to that question.
So let's say that the US is the most powerful country in the world, right? And so everyone gets together and we make some international laws and we decide, okay, we're going to make an enforcement police of some kind. So a military and legal system which is international and which everyone signed up to. Even if we did that, do you think if the power dynamics of the world changed, say from the US to China or to somewhere else, that it would all crumble?
I think that there isn't really an appetite amongst states in the world at the moment, under the existing doctrines of sovereignty, for an international police force. So either it wouldn't be created, which is the current situation, even though it's actually in the UN Charter in Article 48 that there'll be a military force under a UN staff command. It's there, but it's never been formed. UN staff commands there, but the army is not. Peacekeeping forces, in a way, replaced that, or Security Council authorizations, but we never had the army. So I think in the present system, it's unlikely that it would work. But also, I think we might find it hard to imagine what the politics of a UN army might be. So if we say, well, we think it should enforce international law, then we'd have to ask, well, which international laws would we choose to enforce? Which ones would we choose not to enforce? And indeed, what is international law in this particular area or that particular area? And are we willing to expend blood and iron on this particular enforcement mechanism and not on another? These are extraordinarily complicated questions around enforcement. So I think the idea that there's a rule that needs to be enforced, that could be enforced by the police, is complicated enough in domestic law. On take sexual assault, the conviction rates are down at 5%. So it's very, very difficult to, authorize police action in zones that seem inhospitable to that police action. And we see that with domestic violence. And I would say that the international system has a sort of inhospitability in the same sort of sense that perhaps the domestic or private sphere does. We know that today in Britain, there are, children being assaulted by their parents on a daily basis. And yet we can't exactly agree that enforcement action should be taken against the perpetrators, even though those acts are clearly illegal. And that's largely because there seem to us to be other imperatives around than saving children from their parents, namely the sanctity of the private sphere and our sort of fear of the police as well, and our sense that the police should stay out of our homes. And I think those rather familiar, but again, not much talked about ideas in domestic society can be mapped quite usefully onto international law. When we start thinking about enforcement, it immediately becomes rather messy and blurry at the edges.
I think it kind of goes back to what you were saying as well, Tomas, a while ago, of like different moral values, moral imperatives that different people ultimately value and ultimately hierarchize.
I want to go back to something Thomas said at the beginning, though. He mentioned that, moral standards can be very pluralistic in some ways. And in fact, that was the argument that the American delegation made at the Treaty of Versailles when the idea of crimes against humanity were first introduced into the legal order. There was an effort to apply crimes against humanity to the Germans, who had been described as committing all sorts of terrible offenses on the Eastern and Western fronts during the war. And the American delegation came to Versailles and said, we don't really understand or recognize this concept of crimes against humanity. There is no such thing as humanity. There are just many, many humanities. You use a phrase a bit like that. There are many ways to think about these particular acts, many humanities, many nations, many cultures, and they rather poured water on an idea that has actually become extraordinarily familiar to us now. We all go around talking about crimes against humanity all the time. It's a lingua franca amongst people, whether they're international lawyers or not. But it started off as a very, very contentious idea for precisely those reasons. It seemed to, in a way, be a site of conflict between universalists and relativists.
Yeah, and it might be also a sign of cultural superiority from the West, that we know what the universal morality is, and so we're going to decide for everyone.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think there's great, I find that there is a great belief in the idea of humanity and a great suspicion of its representations in the world amongst, relatively sophisticated people. It seems to me that they're understandably torn between the impulse to think that there is such a thing as humanity that might be offended by certain acts out there in the world and feel pain and want to respond to them, but also a sense that the idea of humanity has a very violent history and is sort of dependent in a way on an outer limit, as Carl Schmitt said, that European civilization, for example, has always depended on the space beyond it, the savage, the barbarian. In many ways, Europe is constituted by its outsiders. And it's interesting the way colonial violence, for example, just wasn't a real subject of international law until the sort of mid-20th century. And yet, at the beginning of the 20th century, European international lawyers came together and acted as if the two wars in Europe were the first time there'd been this level of violence in the world. So it's an extraordinary situation, really.
Yeah, and this links on perfectly to my next topic. Professor Gary Simpson, if I'm not mistaken, you're currently writing a book regarding the Cold War and the mediation of nuclearism. Now, it is undeniable that the Cold War was perhaps one of the most polarizing moments of contemporary history, where the two sides profoundly disagreed with each other in almost every possible sense. It is also undeniable that during this time, the biggest project to universalize human rights and morals began. Interestingly or not, each of these sides had their own version of what universal human rights should be, translated into the ECCPR and the ECSCR. And my question is whether the history of human rights development itself reveals the ultimate flaw of this project.
I don't know. It's hard to say that human rights as a project has failed exactly. And I hesitate to describe its flaws because it feels a bit sort of superior in a way to say that this project that so many people have invested their lives in, good-hearted people, people who didn't go and work in the corporate sector but work for Amnesty International, have somehow been misconceived at some level. But I do think certain questions have to be asked. I think, for example, and someone like Sam Moyn has asked this question, what is the relationship between human rights and contemporary capitalism? It seems to me that human rights and capitalism, even the sort of turbo capitalism that we're now entering, the period of turbo capitalism that we've now been in for quite a while, it seems to me that human rights is very, very compatible with that massive maldistribution of wealth, that the rights to free speech, for example, in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, aren't really in any obvious way incompatible with the rise of people like Elon Musk and the concentration of speech. So it seems to me that there are certain forms of economic and political distribution that human rights isn't very good at noticing, not to mention that it tends to juridify everything. So you always end up in court somehow, trying to work out how to convert what might be a human need or a political imperative into a legalistic right with all the problems associated with that. But I just to go back to the Cold War, I mean, my argument following from someone like Susan Buck Morse is that, in fact, the Americans and the Soviets sort of shared a project during the Cold War that there wasn't polarized as you might imagine. And one way in which it wasn't polarized is they were both examples of a universalizing European or quasi-European modernity, that both of these states emerged from a kind of French revolutionary belief in the sovereignty of the people and a belief in the relationship. Different in each case, but nevertheless, the relationship between equality and liberty, with fraternity sort of going missing a bit. And the idea of fraternity actually arose from the Global South to a certain extent during the Cold War. So I think the Cold War could be understood as a moment of Amero-Soviet collaboration, quite literal collaboration over lots of things. We have nuclear weapons, you don't, is one of the great rules of the Cold War period. And that was a joint Amero-Soviet project to keep nuclear weapons within the hands of the great European moderns.
Thank you. Bringing back what you were saying a while ago, do you see any success and you see it as more normatively feasible to try and encompass all imaginable human rights and human values and morals into a single document?
Well, I think we've come to the point where, like, if you look at the global GDP adjusted for inflation over the past 50 years or 100 years or 200 years, I think we've come to the point where it's undeniable that we can actually feed everyone and get everyone basic education and clothes and so on. And so I think I don't see a problem in writing down that every human has a right to those things. Maybe I would answer differently if there was some kind of UN police, which would be enforcing everyone to do this in every single condition possible, right? But I think that human rights make absolute sense. And maybe they make the most sense if there's something which countries and each humankind in the privacy of their mind or their heart try to aspire towards rather than something which is being enforced. Maybe if it were that enforceable, maybe it would ruin it because it would move from the dimension of morality and kindness to the dimension of being controlled, right? Which nobody really likes. It reminds me a bit of that classic story in Freakonomics where there was this kindergarten and people were starting to pick up their kids late. And so they decided, okay, from now on, it's £20 if you're later than half an hour. And the number of people who saw that penalty as an added service they could pay for was quite large. And so it made the problem worse. So yeah, I think maybe I will never know this unless I could go to a parallel universe where there is an enforcement police. But I actually feel it's one of those things that maybe it's better off staying in the dimension of morality and shared goals of humanity. And in that sense, I think the UN is very useful in the sense of a place to share ideas and to come up with these answers of, okay, what are we all striving for? What can we agree on?
So would you say that when we focus too much on the legal discourse, we're in fact crystallizing what are inherently political ideals and entrenching them rather than talking about things we should aspire to?
Yeah, it's like making a contract with your child for feeding him. It's going to ruin it. That's not the reason you should be caring for your child.
Would you agree with that, Professor Gray Simpson?
Yeah, very strongly. I mean, it's an interesting analogy. I often wonder why we don't come together and decide how we are going to distribute the goods that make life worth living, like, for example, food and housing, instead of allowing an unjust world to emerge and then listing a series of rights that we feel are not being realized in that world. It seems like a very roundabout way to do politics, to say what we need to do here in relation to food or speech is get people to notice that they're in a terrible situation, go to their lawyer and bring a case at the European Court of Human Rights. If they win the case, then they might get some compensation themselves. Everyone who didn't bring the case may not. This is what happens with the right to health very often. It's used by sometimes relatively powerful groups to get extremely expensive medicines paid for by national health services, while other people further down the chain are impoverished or denied basic services in the national health system of the state. So the rights can have very, very asymmetrical consequences. And I sometimes think it's just the wrong way around. If we want a just society, maybe we have to ask ourselves what that just society ought to look like and work towards it, work towards the redistribution of goods. To me, the United Kingdom at the moment feels like a very, very wealthy country, but a country in which wealth is distributed in a radically asymmetrical way. But rights don't really speak to that. So the kinds of preferences and advantages enjoyed by the elite in Britain, and I include myself here, by the way, are untouched by the human rights system. There's nothing in the human rights system that threatens the wealth that I hold and the wealth that people in my socioeconomic group hold. For example, the rights that really matter in this country are the right to own a second and third house, the right to charge very high rent to impoverished students, the right to drive the creative classes out of London, the right to drive very, very large four-wheel drives that are wrecking the environment. These are rights that no government could ever take away from the English middle classes without having to fall on its sword in an election. Whereas, funnily enough, rights to free speech or rights not to be tortured are often subject to quite delicate balancing acts by states. So the very rights that we think of as sort of fundamental in the human rights system are quite negotiable, as it turns out. You know, yes, there's no power of the British state to commit acts of torture, but you know, when torture evidence is used in courts, well, you know, can we? If the Syrians do the torturing and we discover something, can we use that evidence in a British court? These are sort of nice, delicate questions of law, and you know, that's fine. But it is remarkable that those sorts of rights are the ones that have often been subject to interpretive dilemmas, whereas the unwritten rights of the elite are, as I say, untouchable. I would call them peremptory or non-derogable norms of international human rights law. It's just that they're not listed in any human rights convention. They don't have to be. They're so natural to the maldistribution of power that no one even has to mention them. In fact, it's best that they're hidden away altogether.
Would you agree with this, Tomas? Do you think we have our hierarchies wrong? We have our priorities wrongly sketched out?
I think, Gary, I think I understand why you would feel that emotionally it's strange that we don't talk about having a second or third house, but we do about other things. But I think it's because owning a second or third house doesn't create direct harm to anyone or accumulating wealth per se. Whereas some people would say that freedom of speech has more of a gray area and torture has more of a gray area. So I think it's, I understand what you're saying, but I'm in favor of people not being limited in their wealth. They should be taxed for it, but they shouldn't have anyone limiting how many houses they have, for instance.
Yeah, I think that's kind of true. I think indirect harms are just as harmful as direct harms. I suppose that's the way I would put it. I think when people accumulate extreme levels of wealth or even multiple houses, that does have an effect on the ability of a whole generation, never mind class, of people to actually own wealth themselves or own houses themselves. So if there's a sort of basic right to housing, which there is in the International Economic and Social Convention, then that right to housing is unlikely to be affected much by cases brought under the heading a right to housing, especially in a society where the distribution of housing is so radically wrong-headed and where so many people do own three or four homes that they spend sometimes 13, 14, 15 days in a year. So you see villages that are empty of people because they're full of London second homeowners. And that seems almost direct, actually, not so much indirect. The generation of young farmers, fishermen, workmen who just can't live in their homes anymore because the homes were too beautiful. It was fatal to them.
Makes sense. Thank you. Thank you for this conversation. I think to end it off, I would like each of you to recommend a book and talk a bit about your current interests slash research.
So I'm reading this book here. It's called Breaking the Social Media Prison by Chris Bayle. It has everything to do with my project, right? It's about depolarizing, it's about echo chambers and so on. And it's been quite interesting because it kind of does away with this common knowledge we all have that if only we were exposed to different echo chambers than our own, then we would suddenly become very open-minded and very good at debating with the other side. And it turns out it's not that simple. It depends on what kind of person you are. So if you are a specific kind of person, which actually turns out to be the minority, then yes, maybe being exposed to a different echo chamber will depolarize you and will give you nuance. But for most people, it turns out it only polarizes them more because most people aren't that politically knowledgeable about everything that's being discussed. And so if the first time they're impacted by something like this new topic, which they've never heard about, is through someone outside their echo chamber, then that will make them immediately take a stance, the opposite stance. So it kind of depends on how informed you are. And it's been very interesting because I think and I talk a lot about these issues, and it's kind of breaking some of my dogmas.
Oh, thanks so much. What do you think about this, Professor Gary Simpson? Just a quick question. Like, is it inherently impossible to convince certain people that there is another perspective and there are other people in the opposite spectrum who want to improve society just as much as them, but simply have different views?
Absolutely. I mean, it must be because human development tells us it is. States have changed, places have changed, people have changed repeatedly throughout history. There are societies in which what we've been calling human rights have, to a certain extent, flourished, and societies in which they are completely negligible. So there is a difference between living under a genocidal dictatorship and living somewhere else. And that difference is important, and the difference must have something to do with the way ideas circulate in those societies. And there's nothing natural about the way ideas circulate. Ideas are human-made creations and therefore can be human unmade as well. So I do think that it's important to keep in mind the continuing power that ideas have to change the world.
Thanks so much. And what about you? Just final question, Professor Gary Simpson. Can you give us some insights into the book you're currently working on?
I'm writing a book about atomic nuclear war at the moment. I'm writing about the experience of nuclear war in the West between 1960 and 1995 as a way of shedding light on the current circumstances. So I'm trying to say something in my book that is new about the experience of living under the threat of mass annihilation on a daily basis without noticing it.
Oh, interesting. All right. Thank you so much for coming once again, and I'm sure that everyone is going to love this podcast.